Thank you, and we have many thanks this afternoon. I'm Johanna Mendelson-Forman. I'm with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, but the thank yous really go to my sponsors here, Dr. Sidney Weintraub, who is the William Simon Chair in Economics, and to my colleagues Karen von Hippel, of the co-director of the Post-Conflict Unit, Jennifer McAvee of the International Security Program, and Wamik Chowdhury, who's outside taking names, and Shannon Hayden, who also is with the Post-Conflict Unit. All of these people contribute when we have an event of this size, and I just want to say again thank you to everybody who gave their time to bring us a wonderful speaker this afternoon, Dr. Paul Collier, who needs very little introduction, but since I'm always given the honor of being the chair, I will do some introduction because it wouldn't be fair not to say that Paul Collier in many ways changed my thinking in my life about conflict and about the economics of conflict to a person who was a numerate when I worked at the World Bank. And I think that friendship has been there, I think, either out of sympathy or out of whatever. But he has made a profound influence on my life as far as my thinking goes, and really has, in this latest book, The Bottom Billion, certainly given to the broad public what we had the opportunity to share in a smaller microcosm at the World Bank when I was in the first post-conflict unit there, to understand more profoundly why some of the countries that continue to fail, and what we have learned through the teachings of both economics and other social sciences about how we can move ahead. Now, if I were a biblical person, I would say that Paul's poverty traps, the four traps that he talks about, which are conflict, being landlocked and having poor neighbors, having abundant natural resources and bad governance, are the biblical equivalent in the 21st century of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. So instead of pestilence, we have conflict, war, famine, and death. We now have these traps. And I think what I hope Paul Collier will talk about today is how these traps have kept what he calls the bottom billion in a place which is so sad and so disappointing, and yet also offers some hopeful signs based on what we know and the research and the good hard research, both field and statistical research, which show ways to get out of these various traps. So rather than take up more time and tell you about the book, which, by the way, is also offered for sale outside, that we were kind enough to get Borders Books to come in and offer it, and it has had glowing reviews, I'm going to let Paul Collier talk about it himself. I know we have a biographical sheet outside. I don't think I need to go into great details about a man who is as well known as Paul Collier, but as you know, he's at Oxford University. Before that, he was at the World Bank in the as chief economist dealing with research in the social science area, and his list of accolades go on, but I think you can read them for yourself in the sheet that we have. So thank you. Thank you for joining us. Thank you, Sid, again, for letting us host this, and I'll turn the microphone over to you.
Thank you very much for inviting me. For somebody of a rather retiring disposition, I've had a tough afternoon. So far this afternoon, I've done a television program, a radio interview, and now this. And if I keep on like this, I'll end up in Vanity Fair. I can see it.
So I have to go with Paris Hilton tonight on CNN.
I'm under very strict instructions from my publisher. At no stage must I say what is actually in my book, because then you won't buy it. But let me breach that. What is it actually about? And what it's about is first and foremost to try and get you to reconceptualize what the development problem and the development challenge is. And for 40 years, for all my working lifetime, the development problem has really been a world of 5 billion people in developing countries and a billion in the rich countries. And I think that's no longer a useful way of conceptualizing development. Most people in developing countries are living in countries which are developing very fast or are already middle income. That is to say, they are living in countries which are converging on the rich countries. In fact, they're converging at rates which are historically unprecedented. That does not mean that all those 4 billion people are doing all right. Some of them are not, right? There's a lot of poor people in India and China, but at least they're living in societies whose economies are performing very strongly, and if those societies manage themselves well, those societies can be suffused with hope for everybody. That's not true for a bunch of 50 to 60 countries that are now at the bottom of the world economy. For the last 40 years, the average per capita growth rate of the billion people in those countries has been 0.1% a year, population weighted. In other words, they've been stagnant. Incidentally, that statistic tells you why poverty is not actually a very good diagnostic of the problem. Whether poverty in this group has gone up a bit or down a bit kind of misses the point. The key phenomenon is divergence from the rest of mankind. And that divergence has steadily accelerated over the last 40 years and is continuing even today. In fact, for the last 20 years, the average rate of divergence between the bottom billion and the next 4 billion has averaged about 5% a year, which is an astoundingly rapid rate of divergence. And the gap between the bottom billion, the average citizen of the bottom billion, and the next 4 billion is already 5-1. So before we get to the billion who are rich, us, as it were, there's already a massive problem. And so, first and foremost, we need to refocus the development agenda on the billion that are shearing off from the rest of mankind. And it's that divergence which is the problem, and it has to be reversed. They have to catch up. We have to switch divergence to convergence. Whether poverty goes down a bit is not a sensible metric for whether we're winning or losing on that problem. Divergence of the bottom billion is, to my mind, just going to be socially unsustainable in a world which is socially integrating, both through migration and information flows. The bottom billion know that they are at the bottom, and they're going to know that they are diverging, and that will be explosive. So, what can we do about it? In order to know what to do about it, we have to spend a little time thinking what's causing it. And if you've got a megastar like Jeff Sachs, he'd give you an answer that is, there's a trap and it's called poverty. Right? And I like Jeff, I have a lot of time for him, but I don't buy that as an explanation. I just can't believe that poverty is much of a trap, because around the world, most people were poor and most people have escaped it. Right? What is the nature of the problem? I think the bottom billion, and there are about 50 or 60 countries there, are a little bit analogous to Tolstoy's description of families. You remember his view, happy families are all much of a muchness, is any one way of being happy, but there's several ways of being unhappy, right? I think the countries at the bottom are a little bit like that. There is no one-size-fits-all explanation for the problem of the countries for whom globalization is not working. For most countries, globalization is working. For these, it's not. But it's not working in rather different ways. And I diagnose four, if you like, traps, which I think between them account for the problem. And so, actually, my definition of the billion at the bottom is that they live in countries which are in one or more of these traps. So it's not that they're just the poorest countries, it's that they're in one or other of these traps. And what are the traps? As Joanna said, one is the conflict trap. I've written a lot about that over the years. Why is it a trap? Well, because once you've got conflict, it goes on for an awful long time. Whilst you're in it, it's development in reverse, it destroys your economy. And even when you come out of it, you've got a 40% risk of going back into conflict within the next decade. Right? Terrible. So that's conflict. The next trap is let's take the landlocked trap. Now, Jeff Sachs was actually the first person to say landlockedness is a problem, and the slick answer to Jeff was, of course it's not a problem, you know, look at Switzerland or whatever. And that, or Botswana. And that's too slick a response, but it's half right. Why is it that Botswana's okay and Switzerland okay and Uganda is not okay? And the answer is that it's twofold. One is that if you've got a lot of natural resources like Botswana, your fate is determined by whether you use those resources well, not by whether you're landlocked. Right? So it's not being landlocked, it's being landlocked without any valuable resources. Okay? Outside Africa, only 1% of the world's developing population lives in such countries. In Africa, it's 30%. We could repackage that statistic and say outside Africa, places that are landlocked and resource scarce haven't become countries. And in Africa, they did. Now, it was probably pretty sensible for places that are landlocked and resource scarce not to become countries. Too late. There are a stack of countries with those characteristics. Can't redraw the borders now. They're there. So what can they do? Well, they can still be Switzerland. Germany, Italy, France are not in the way of Switzerland's market. It doesn't say, God, we wish Germany, Italy, and Switzerland would sink into the sea and we could get to our market by boat. They are Switzerland's market. And then try that for Uganda. Look at a map and go round. What's it got? Sudan. Great. Democratic Republic of the Congo, Rwanda, Tanzania, which invaded it, and Kenya, which for 20 years had President Daniel Arap Moi. In other words, it's in a bad neighborhood. And so if you're going to be landlocked and resource scarce, your best hope is to piggyback on the growth of your neighbors. And that doesn't work if your neighbors are just not taking their opportunities or don't have any. And a lot of the bottom billion countries are in that dilemma. Niger cannot grow unless Nigeria gets its act together. Nigeria doesn't even need to know that Niger is next to it. And so it's not a reciprocal power relationship. For years, Nigeria didn't harness its opportunities. There was nothing Niger could do about it. And it sank the prospects for Niger. So that's the landlocked. The third category is the resource-rich Nigeria. Now, resource-rich is an opportunity. You can do Botswana. But usually, it's a nightmare. You end up like Nigeria. Why? I've just, since writing The Bottom Billion, done a lot more work on this, and it's on my website. But basically, the resource rents contaminate the politics, and with bad governance, these resources are not just wasted, it's far worse. I've tried to do a simulation of Africa's present commodity booms based upon the global relationship between commodity prices and growth for commodity exporters. It's a global relationship. I find that Africa is very seldom different from global relationships. What's distinctive about Africa is its bundle of characteristics, not its behavior. Africa's disproportionately got a lot of natural resources, and so how natural resources play out globally matters a lot for Africa. But how they play out globally is the following. If you've got good governance, say like Norway, a commodity boom delivers big growth in the short run and continues to deliver growth in the long run. Short run, hunky-dory. Long run, hunky-dory. If you start with poor governance, and you get that same commodity boom, the short run is still hunky-dory. Up it goes, right? The long run is Humpty Dumpty. You fall off a wall, right? In fact, you end up poorer than where you started, a lot poorer. That's what happened last time. Right? It doesn't have to be like that this time, but it will be unless the incentives for behavior are different. Right? And so that's got to be a huge challenge. We'll come back to it later if we get the chance. So we've done the conflict trap, the landlocked trap, the resource trap. And the final trap is if you start off with really dreadful policies, which an awful lot of developing countries did. If you go back 30 or 40 years, the world leader in lousy policies was probably China, right? Don't forget that, right? Africa had nothing on China for bad policies, right? The difference is in the pace of reform out of bad policy and being very small, having very few educated people, actually makes the pace of reform much slower. You just don't have a critical mass of educated people. Simple things. For example, your market is too small to support a financial press. There are no decent newspapers. And so you can't even conduct a debate on what is wrong. Right? And so China, India had the scale to diagnose what was wrong, develop an alternative strategy, and implement it. And the Central African Republic doesn't. And so the process of reform is just much slower. Now, a lot of Africa has now reformed, but it took longer than Asia. And that turns out to be crucial for one bunch of countries, which are the coastal countries that have missed the boat of globalization. The globalization boat sailed past the developing world in the 1980s. What is the boat? It's labor-intensive manufacturers. That's the fast track to development. Jobs, jobs, jobs. Okay? Until the 1980s, nobody was on board because the huge-scale agglomerations that Europe and America got effectively protected them from any fear of competition. And then in the 1980s, Asia got in. Now, Asia has still got cheap labor, but it's built up these huge clusters of manufacturing exports which drive costs down massively. Right? One of the most amazing statistics on globalization I've come across is the following. Gentlemen, look at your shirts, right? 60% of the world's buttons are made in one Chinese city, right? That's what agglomeration economies means, right? How on earth is Africa going to compete in buttons? Right? It can't. And so by having allowed Asia to get in, because at the time Asia got policies, got ahead in its reform programs faster than Africa, Africa has missed the boat. And so even fairly weakly governed places like Bangladesh managed to get in and now have about 3 million jobs in garments. If Kenya could have broken in, if Kenya had got 3 million jobs in garments, it would transform the economy. Yeah? Kenya's now reforming. Great. It's too late. So that's the waterfront of problems. What can we do about it? And the final part of, in a way, the main part of the bottom billion is to look at what can you do. Right? This would obviously be a sensible place to stop and force you to buy it. But let me go on for a bit. The policy message of the bottom billion is that just as we've defined the problem much too broadly, 5 billion people instead of one, when it comes to solutions, we've defined the solutions much too narrowly. Aid, aid, aid. Double it, double it, double it. Right? Now, I am not in the camp which says aid is the problem. I think aid can be helpful, is helpful, and I'd like to see more of it. But I don't think it's a very powerful instrument for the countries of the bottom billion. Right? If that's the only instrument we have, we've lost. Right? And this is, as it were, the problem, the dilemma we're in, that why is Africa and the bottom billion on the agenda at all? Because the celebrities have done the work of mobilizing people to force it onto the agenda. But that same process is the Vanity Fairization of Africa, and it trivializes. And so the agenda shrinks at the same time as it actually reaches the top table, and it shrinks to aid. I mean, it's actually worse than that. It shrinks even in terms of the content of aid. It becomes the glamour bits of aid rather than the serious growth bits of aid. Right? But aid is just overplayed, and so I don't want to say any more about it. Right? It's part of the solution. It's not that important. There are huge policy areas that are totally neglected that we've got to wake up to. Take a problem like the recovery of Europe after the Second World War. A serious problem, and so America rose to the occasion and did something serious about it. And what did it do? Yes, it did aid the Marshall Plan. What else did it do? Trade. General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. A massive reversal in the history of American trade policy. What else did it do? Governance. Massive governance interventions. OECD, encouragement of the European community. Basically, collective efforts to improve governance in Europe. And finally, security. NATO, right? Massive security provision. That is the menu of policies that America used in getting serious about recovering Europe. The problem of turning the bottom billion round is a harder problem than recovering Europe after the Second World War. It actually needs the same array of instruments. It needs us to get serious. So that's the waterfront of policies, basically. It's those four. And I'll just quickly sketch the non-aid policies and close. Trade. My hobby horse on trade at the moment is... which I was trying to get onto the G8 agenda, and it got crowded out at the last minute by all this attention to aid, is to try and shoehorn Africa into global manufacturing markets. In other words, the boat sailed past Africa in the 1980s. Africa didn't jump on board. When will the boat come back if we leave it to market forces? Well, I can tell you, right? We can predict it. We have to wait until the wage gap between Africa and Asia is roughly what the wage gap was between Asia and Europe and America at the time Asia broke in, right? So our grandchildren can come back to a meeting like this, right? We wait a long time. Right? Can we bring the boat back artificially? Yes, we can. As a European, of course, Europe's supposed to care about Africa and America as a heartless place which doesn't care. That's the if you were over the other side of the Atlantic, that's what you'd be told. It's therefore particularly embarrassing that actually on trade policy, America's got it right and Europe's got it wrong. What America did was the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, AGOA, which gave Africa privileged access to American markets for a pretty limited range of manufacturers. There's only one part of AGOA which works, and that's the part covered by something called the special waiver, which allows garments in. Right? With trade policy, the devil is always in the detail. And there's some nasty things called rules of origin, which if you don't know what they are, don't ask. Right? America's got it right. Over the last 5 years, there's been a sevenfold expansion of African garments exports to America. Now, America didn't get it very right until December, because the average renewal time until then was only 18 months. So if you were a firm exporting, say, in Madagascar, you could make good money, but then you'd think, do we actually want to invest with an 18-month horizon? In December, you extended it for 5 years. That's the minimum sort of sensible horizon. Right? What's Europe got? Well, Europe proudly displays the equivalent called Everything But Arms, except that it doesn't work. Right? It would be better called Everything But Arms and Manufactures. I'll give you two examples. Again, the devil is in the detail. If we were serious, we could get this policy right. No trouble. Nobody loses. Africa's such a tiny drop in the world market. Nobody damages. Nobody's damaged. Right? The reason we don't get it right is that nobody can be bothered to give it, at the top, can be bothered to give it the serious attention it takes just to fix it. I've talked with the European Trade Commissioner, with the European Chief Civil Servant on Trade, and they know the issues. I'll give you two examples, right? If you want to go and set up manufacturing and exporting shirts to Europe in Africa, you can do so in some countries in Africa, but not others. So let's try a couple, right? Somalia, Kenya, right? One of those countries, you're allowed to set up a shirts factory and export to Europe, and the other, you're not. Right? Yes, you can go to Somalia and set up a shirts factory, right? And you're allowed into Europe, actually sort of, but not Kenya. Right? In other words, it's covering the wrong countries. Right? But just to make sure, I asked the Director General of Trade Policy in the European Commission, why are you doing that? He said, oh, we want to focus it, the benefits, on the most needy. Well, it's true. You know, there's a lot of sense in that. Somalia is more needy than Kenya, right? It's not going to work, of course, but never mind. And just to make sure, in case somebody did sneakily set up a factory in Somalia and try, we've got these things called rules of origin, right? We'd get you there. So Lesotho is in, right? It's allowed to export shirts to Europe and to America. But actually, it exports all its shirts to America because they don't meet the European rules of origin, nor are they likely to anytime soon, right? They're very tough rules of origin. So, I asked the Director General, why have you got such tough rules of origin? He said, oh, we want to encourage large-scale activity. We want them to do a lot of value added, right? These are just gesture politics answers, aren't they? I mean, they're obviously stupid, and they know it. Right? So what they're doing is they're meeting the requirements of gesture politics, which is opinion on the street, and not doing anything that actually works. But they know what would work. So that's an example. I've gone through trade a lot because it's so easy to get this one right. What do we need? Just think about it for one more minute. What we need is a common OECD scheme. We don't want an AGOA and an EBA and goodness knows what the Japanese are going to call their thing. If you're a factory making garments in Africa, there should be one set of rules for market access across the OECD. Yeah? You shouldn't be trying to think, oh, this shirt we can sell there, this shirt we better put some more buttons on it and then we sell it. It's obvious, right? And it's so easy, and it's not been done. Right? Instead, what did the G8 waste their time doing? Posturing about on these gestures of, are we going to make an aid commitment? Yes, we're committed, but not yet, and you know, all this sort of rubbish. Let me turn to the big one at the moment, the really big one, which is the resource booms. Africa's natural resource exports dwarf aid. Right? I mean, these are really serious revenues that are coming in. It's Africa's big opportunity, not just Africa. It's Africa plus the bottom billion, sort of Central Asia looks very, very like Africa. Right? So we've got these huge resource flows going in, and we know what happened last time. And it's incumbent on us to try and do our bit to help the reformers in Africa who are desperately struggling to make sure that history is not repeated. Right? Yesterday I was with my friend Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, and she struggled desperately in Nigeria to get a minimal element of fiscal responsibility enacted. It was called the Fiscal Responsibility Act. Right? And it just managed to pass in a watered-down fashion just at the very end of Obasanjo's regime. And now she tells me that all the governors are already trying to dismantle it. So that tells you she's done something right, right? If it was that hard to get through and they're trying to dismantle it, she's achieved something. But could we make that process more robust? And we could if there were some clear international guidelines and standards, and if our own resource extraction companies were subject to some rules. We can make the rules for our own companies. Right? How are deals struck at the moment in resource extraction? Right? You know, but you don't want to know, right? Just let me give you one simple statistic. The Democratic Republic of the Congo exports of natural resources are somewhere in excess of $200 million a year. Royalties flowing into the treasury of the Democratic Republic of the Congo last year were $86,000. Right? $200 million of exports and $86,000 of royalties. Right? Not a lot. Right? So what's happening at the moment, and what happened spectacularly in the Democratic Republic of Congo, is companies are doing deals where a little bit is paid over the table, quite a lot is paid under the table. It's a very good deal for the minister, it's a very good deal for the company, and it's a rotten deal for the country. And ministers who are there just for the moment, in DRC it was a transition government which threw a lot of the royalties away, are signing deals for years to come. And so rights are signed away. This is asset stripping on a grand scale. And we shouldn't tolerate it. There need to be some international rules which say, it's the equivalent of odious debt, which says, if you have got your contract other than by certain transparent means, which I would say has to be through an international public auction, and that auction needs to be verified by some process of certification. If you've not got your mineral rights through that process, it's void in international law. Right? That's what we need to do. And we could do it. Right? Of course, we won't for a while. We'll just let cowboys strip Africa of its minerals. And then eventually there'll be some very messy process of change. But it's clear what we ought to do. We could enormously help the reformers in Africa by complementing that with clear guidelines of how these resources should be managed. We did one little step towards that. It was a very good step, the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative. As soon as that was promulgated, Ngozi and her friends in Nigeria adopted it. They said, this is the standard for Nigeria. Yeah? And that's an example where an international voluntary standard provides a rallying cry for local reformers to use. And it's also a damn sight easier to defend than ad hoc things that reformers put together. Yeah? You're either on an international standard or you're not. We started to do it with diamonds, but we need to do it much more generally across the board. Let me close with a couple of remarks on security. Security is kind of the hard one because of Iraq, right? And if you just look at the history of security interventions, we lurch. Right? Intervene in Somalia, panic, come out. Don't intervene is the lesson from Somalia. What do we get? Rwanda. Right? Then, goodness, we get it right. We get it right with Sierra Leone. Right? The most effective form of aid that I think Africa's ever had is a few hundred troops that bring peace and secure the peace in Sierra Leone. It's very cheap. It's the difference between night and day. It gives Sierra Leone a real opportunity. And it's a one-off. The French used to, in their own inimitable style, provide a sort of ad hoc security guarantee for their own, as it were. And there were many features of that that were not very attractive. But I looked to see, well, did it work? Right? And so I've got a model of conflict risk. And so I put Francophone Africa into the a dummy for Francophone Africa into the model. And we can actually date the end of the French security guarantee very precisely. It's the late 1990s, and it manifested itself in the coup d'etat in Côte d'Ivoire, when the French elite were divided. The professional advisors to the president said, we must intervene as usual to put this coup down, and President Chirac, consistent with a long history of his decisions, jumped the wrong way, in my view, and didn't intervene, and we got a successful coup and then a civil war. So it's really a French policy that begins in the 1960s, ends in the late 90s. And it reduced the risk of civil war in Francophone Africa by two-thirds during that period. So there are many features of it that were lousy. Basically, the rules of engagement were hopeless. What ended French intervention was Rwanda, when the French came disturbingly close to propping up a regime bent on genocide, and they just backed off in time. And that's why they drew the wrong conclusions from that. I mean, the right conclusions were that security guarantees must be provided in a context of explicit conditions. There need to be some, as it were, democratic red lines. And instead, they just backed off completely and left Côte d'Ivoire to its fate, which has produced an intractable mess. So there's things we can do on the security front. There are a number of democratic regimes in Africa held hostage by their own militaries for fear of coup d'etat. They shouldn't be. So that's a quick overview of the sort of waterfront of policies. And in a nutshell, it's broaden the array of policies and narrow the focus of those policies down to this billion at the bottom. If we did that, we could fix the problem. But if we go on as we are, we won't fix the problem and it will become explosive. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you, Paul, for that excellent overview of your book. I don't think you've revealed every word, and your publisher will be pleased. We have about, probably 20 minutes for some questions. And so if you'll please identify yourself, we'll begin. The gentleman over there, and then Ken Macon.
My name is Andy Brodbank, and I noted that the question of poverty, there's an issue of the question of population growth.
I think it is important, and I think it's important because having a large cohort of young people has two adverse consequences. One is it makes a country actually much more exposed to the risk of large-scale violence. The proportion of young men in a society is a very big risk factor, right? Unfortunately, right? That's just how it is. It makes rebellion a whole lot more feasible if you've got the combination of poverty and a lot of young men. Right? The second way in which it has adverse consequences is it shifts the structure of the education budget towards primary education and away from secondary and tertiary. And that the consequence of that is that you just never build up an educated elite. And so the decade of the 90s, education for all, was the slogan. What that meant was shift budget from tertiary to primary, which happened. You can see the rationale for that, and you can also see the consequences. Right? I'm a professor. I deal all the time with colleagues in African universities, though most of my colleagues that were in African universities are now in American universities, right? Because African universities are absolutely teetering on the edge because they're so under-resourced. And the consequence of that for these societies is that their very limited talent is hemorrhaging abroad and they just don't have the skill base at home. So I agree with you.
Let's take a few more questions. I have Ken Bacon. I have this gentleman over here. I have Norman Daly. I have this lady. Go ahead, Ken.
Ken Bacon, Refugees International. Thank you for a terrific presentation. I wanted to follow up on your comments about Sierra Leone and the importance of security there. I take your point, but so often when wars end, there is minimal investment in peace immediately after the end. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about things that the World Bank and other institutions could do to minimize the chances of slipping back to war, increasing the chances of a sustainable peace.
Yeah, I think the post-conflict situations are actually the big opportunity of making a safer world. Because at any one time, there aren't that many of them. They've got such a high risk of going wrong that if we can focus our resources and fix that problem, half of all civil wars are conflict relapses. So we could halve the incidence of civil war just by getting post-conflict right. Okay. Now, what would it take? These are the situations where they need big money. A lot of the countries at the bottom billion that are at long-term peace actually have really quite limited ability to use big aid. But the post-conflict situations really do have an ability to use big aid. What can that aid do? Some pretty simple things. The heartland of post-conflict actually is reconstruction. One of the things reconstruction does is generate a lot of jobs, if you get it right, jobs for unskilled people. Now, you've got to have complementary policies. One of those complementary policies is building up some very mundane skills that wither away during prolonged civil war. Right? During civil war, the economy is specialized on destruction, and so there isn't a whole lot of construction. And so the skills needed for construction disappear. Yeah? There aren't any bricklayers, electricians, all that sort of stuff. So you need, as a matter of urgency, to build up that very mundane set of skills, which can then complement harnessing a lot of unskilled labor. Yeah? So it's a very simple agenda, that. There's a financial aspect, there's a skill aspect, and a mundane skill aspect, and then there's a reform agenda, an economic reform agenda. There's far too much attention, in my view, paid to the politics relative to the economics. Typical post-conflict country starts with very bad economic policies, and there's a very simple reason for that, which is that countries during war, their governments resort to every policy trick in the book, as long as in the short run it brings in a bit of revenue, right? Or shores up your support base, a bit of patronage here and there. Right? So cumulatively, you build up terrible policies, and the chickens are just coming home to roost by the time you get to peace. So there's a huge economic reform agenda, and there's nobody to implement it. Right? Think what happened in Liberia. The first thing the new government did was sack the entire Ministry of Finance. Right? There's no competent skill base there. The civil service is part of the problem, not part of the solution. And so you actually need a lot, I think, of technical assistance in that early phase. You need to import the complex skills and train up on the sort of the construction skills. Of course, gradually you've got to train up the complex skills, but some of the complex skills you never need. You don't need in the long run, you just need them during the reform. And so those you might as well import. But you need big technical assistance. And typically, they don't get it. Yeah? I remember being asked at the World Bank 3 months after the big change of regime in Liberia, do you know somebody we could send? We're thinking of sending somebody. My God, right? This had been on the cards for ages. There should have been a team on a plane the day after. And there wasn't, right? So there should be big technical assistance, big money, and a lot of rather focused training on the bottleneck skills. At the same time, there should typically be a prolonged commitment to external peacekeeping. I've studied the UN peacekeeping role. It works. It is effective in bringing down the risks. There is no quick political fix that I can find. Post-conflict elections shift the risk. They don't lower it. The year before the election, they bring the risk down. The year after the election, they push it up even more, which means, incidentally, that a post-conflict election is not a great milestone for troop withdrawals. Though that's what we are doing. If you look back to the strategy in DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo, the elections were on October the 29th, and the date penciled in for the withdrawal of all peacekeeping troops was October the 30th. Right? As it happened, of course, we had to fly troops in, not out, which was consistent with my own model. But anyway, so post-conflict, there is a lot we can do that we're not doing.
I'm going to group some questions together in the interest of time. Yeah. And I had this gentleman.
You shouldn't have such interesting questions.
Yes, they're very interesting questions. I know we could spend the evening. I have three gentlemen here, and I have a woman on the other side. Perhaps let's take these three first and then do a second round, and I see some other hands up. Yes, thank you.
Ambassador Edmonds, the former ambassador of St. Lucia. I didn't hear you mention the Caribbean. So I assume that we are not in the bottom billion. Nevertheless, I would like to suggest a fifth trap which we are faced with in the Caribbean, and I would call it the external policy trap, meaning by this that the policy of the more developed countries towards the Caribbean, United States, is such that it's very difficult to make a mark in trade, international trade, for example. Take bananas, for example, which was the thriving economy of the islands. We lost it because of very strong lobbying groups in the United States, the Doles, the Chiquitas of this world, which virtually driving us out of the market. We're losing our rum, we're losing our sugar, etc. So it's very difficult for small island states to adjust on a global scene when you have very, very strong lobbying groups. Although our banana production was only 3% of the world trade, we were able to push out of this trade because of the interests and strong lobbying groups, which makes me think that probably, well, first of all, there's no level playing field as far as we're concerned, and I endorse your thought that there's probably no one at the top to fix it. Nevertheless, if we think in terms of global trade, especially for small island states, and think in terms of a level playing field, small islands, limited economies, etc. So what are your thoughts of this? If we qualify in the bottom billion, what are your suggestions? And don't mention Singapore to me because it's a different form of government.
Right.
Thank you. Let's take the two others, Jim Michael and then Norman Bailey. And
okay. Thank you, and again, thank you for the presentation. I wonder if you might say something about incentives for actions by poor countries to improve the quality of governance. I've looked at the international incentives. You know, everybody now can look at the Doing Business report of the World Bank or the Governance Matters or the Millennium Challenge Corporation scorecards or Transparency International. We know that countries that do badly on all of these are not going to be attractive countries for moving into manufacturing investment. And at the same time, it seems to me that the external world doesn't have a lot of weight in making the people who benefit from the bad governance change their tune. And I wonder if you have some thoughts on incentives for better governance.
Thank you very much. Actually, that was my question. You made a remarkably sensible set of comments concerning aid, trade, and security, but said very little about governance, and I'd love to hear your recommendations on that.
You're quite right. Most of the West Indies is not bottom billion, right? At least one is. Haiti's not that great, right? So that's the sort of place I have in mind. I agree with you on bananas. The regime is bananas, right? Let me turn to, in fact, I'm in conversation with the Australian government, which is very worried about a number of small island states in the Pacific, which is sort of look a little bit too like comfort for Haiti, really. Let me turn to the question of improving the quality of governance. It's hard, right? I don't believe that donor conditionality works. I mean, forget that. I've looked at it statistically, and other than post-conflict, I mean, post-conflict situations are relatively fluid. They're good times for reform. Other than that, the mathematical expectation of the time to decisive improvement, if you're small and poor and start with really bad policies, is nearly 60 years. That's based on the probability of a decisive turnaround in any particular year. So you wait a long time. What are it has to be a domestic process, first and foremost, right? And there are moments. There are windows of political opportunity. A leader changes, or the situation gets desperate and a new finance minister is brought in. There are windows of political opportunity, and what we're failing to do is to reinforce those windows. Now, for example, one of the things I find is that once you start these early incipient reforms from very poor policy, big technical assistance is really useful. And I think there's a simple reason for that, which is you only start the reforms when there's some sort of political will. You know, a new minister says, I want to change. And they start a little bit of reform. And then they hit the brick wall, and the brick wall is called the civil service, which doesn't want to change and doesn't know how to change. Yeah? And so what is the technical assistance that you need? Not a lot of advice to the minister, certainly not a lot of lectures saying you should reform. What's needed is just the practical ability to implement what the reformers want to do, whatever their agenda happens to be. And so the sort of technical assistance that's super useful that I've seen again and again on the ground is actually young people with some skills who can do things who are too junior to be a threat to the senior civil servants, so they're not resented as much. But they can actually do what the minister wants. So around the world, you'll see reformers with little teams of basically bright young people that have been brought in to help them. And they're enormously valuable. Right? That's a message to the people at the back of the room, as it were, who are the bright young things. Got one result there, which is, well, actually, yeah, one result was really upsetting, is that it's possible to chill a reform effort as well as promote it. And early money seems to chill. And it doesn't matter whether it's aid money or commodity booms money. They both have this same chilling effect. And I think the reason is kind of, in a way, pretty obvious, that the big impetus to reform from dreadful conditions is necessity. Right? It gets to the point where you just haven't got enough money to finance the patronage that's needed, and something has to give. And so you finally bite the bullet and say, OK, we're going to do change. And then you don't know how to do change. The president appoints the acceptable finance minister, and the acceptable finance minister hopefully gets some technical assistance. And then if there's a commodity boom, why bother? When I think I'm allowed to tell this from Ngozi. When Ngozi was first brought in Nigeria, 2003, of course, she started, the commodity boom was just building up. And I went to see her and said, they started with a budget deficit, and then they got showered with money. And I said to Ngozi, is the high oil prices a help or a hindrance? They're presumably a help in that you're getting, just a lot of revenue in, which is good news for any finance minister, but on balance, are they a help or a hindrance? She just laughed her head off. She said, they're a terrible nuisance, this commodity boom, this oil boom. I cannot get people to focus on the reform agenda. It's driven the reform agenda off the page. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Well, I see a couple of more hands. I'd like to take another round, and this lady here, and then I saw a gentleman there and someone in the back had their hand up. Thank you.
I'm Whitney Johnson from the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. My question is about security policy, and I'm just curious what your thoughts are about the development of Africa Command and how you think that might influence the security situation or automatically the security policy of the U.S. toward Africa, and I guess by extension maybe the governance situation in Africa as well.
Thank you. And there was a gentleman here. Yes?
Kind of along the lines of the ambassador's question about bananas and trade laws, what I noticed was absent from your critique was the use of grain and agricultural subsidies by the major trade powers in that region. And whether or not you still maintain the kind of going theory that an agricultural base is necessary for industrial advancement.
Okay, and one more question in the back there.
I have two remarks. The first one is you'll find this good. You have four categories.
Could you speak up a little bit?
You said something about Europe, too. So what do you think about the African themselves? Are they responsible for their situation? This is the first question. And the second one is you said also that most of the time the aid is not... it's not enough, but I would go farther and say that this aid, the international aid in Africa, creates unfair and bad competition with the local small businesses. Thank you.
Africa needs external security assistance, in my view, but it needs it in the context of an authorizing environment, which is African. And that is the combination we've not really succeeded in putting together. And until we do that, there's an impasse, basically. So the challenge is to reassure Africa that it will be Africa in control. Now, let me, I think I've done some work on the costs of failing states, or whatever one calls them, and the amazing thing is the bulk of the costs accrue to neighbors. The costs are just enormous, first of all. I mean, these failing states are a massive economic phenomena. But the bulk of the costs are to neighbors. Now, what does that mean? I think it means that we have to actually rethink the concept of Westphalian sovereignty. Because at the time of the Westphalian settlement and the idea of national sovereignty, it was broadly true that the consequences of a government were felt fundamentally only by its own citizens. And that, in the context, certainly of Africa's failing states, is just not true. That if you get a state which fails, it's the neighbours which bear most of the costs. And so the neighbours, to my mind, have rights of, I wouldn't say intervention, but of influence over what goes on. In other words, we've got to rethink national sovereignty. Now, the paradox is that, of course, in Europe, national sovereignty has been rethought over the last 50 years massively. And in Africa, it hasn't. Africans have dug in to an absurdly strict notion of total national sovereignty, in my view. Right? Compare, let's say, Germany, the biggest state in Europe, and Burundi, which is not a very big state in Africa. One of these two countries has control of its own exchange rate, its own trade policy, its own security policy, its own fiscal policy, and its own monetary policy, and it ain't Germany, right? And so there's a major imbalance. You know, there is, to my mind, excess sovereignty by governments that are not in a position to bear that responsibility. And so I would like to see, in the typical post-conflict situation, a degree of sovereignty vested for a decade or so in, say, the African Union, which then uses that power and can call upon logistical support for its security operations. So that's the way I would like to see us go forward on security. And instead, what we get is, in a way, much more ambitious assaults on sovereignty. I mean, the responsibility to protect is a much more radical assault on sovereignty than what I'm suggesting. My notion is that a country has the right to protect its own citizens from adverse effects of neighbours. The responsibility to protect argues that America has the right to intervene anywhere on earth if citizens in that country are being upset by their own government. Right? So my view is a radically more limited view of shared sovereignty than the current fashionable UN approach. But we're not yet going down this route of seriously empowering African collective responsibility on the security front. Agricultural trade and the importance of agriculture. Why I focused on manufacturing is that whatever we do on agricultural trade, it kind of just digs Africa, and we should do things on agricultural trade, obviously, but it does dig Africa deeper into dependence on its existing exports, whereas what Africa needs, and not just Africa, is diversification into other things. The magic of manufactured exports is that they don't encounter diminishing returns as you increase them. In fact, on the contrary, as you increase production, costs fall. That's the cluster economies. And so you've basically got two outcomes for manufacturing, either zero or infinity, as it were, for a little country. either you don't get started or you get over a threshold of competitiveness, and then you can just scale up until you run out of labour. And that's the process that we need to ignite in a few African countries. Now, to go back to an earlier question about what's the process of igniting reform, getting some spectacular successes is the process of igniting reform. Africa has lacked spectacular success. Once we could get three or four countries growing at over 10% a year, which is entirely feasible, it would make a huge psychological difference to the region, and it would start all the neighbouring countries trying to emulate. I think the argument that you've got to have a secure agricultural base, to my mind, is actually overplayed. So I realise that's unfashionable, but that's my view. Is Africa responsible? Nothing that I have said is meant to de-responsabilise Africa. I am very hostile to the view that is usually peddled, that Africa is just a victim. I think the Western left has done Africa no favours by the argument that Africa has been immiserized by Western capitalism. It's not true, but worse than that, much worse than that, it's hugely disempowering for Africans. Because if I have stagnated because of you, if all I am is a victim, what can I do about it? And I don't even need to ask what I can do about it, because it's you that's done it to me, right? And so it's a hugely disempowering agenda. It's, of course, a very mischievous agenda, because the people who advocate that agenda are not actually talking to Africa. They're critiquing their own societies, which is a great fun, but does inadvertently this huge disservice.
We have one last question, I know, from our co-host, Sid Weintraub. I'd like to turn it over to you also for some closing words, because we've gone over our time, but I know this has been a fascinating discussion. And for those of you who we didn't get to, I apologize, but you'll be able to catch Dr. Collier on the way out. Thank you.
Well, let me just talk about two fascinating things you talked about, at least to me. You talked about sovereignty just now, not elimination, but limited. And it depends on the circumstances and whatnot. Okay, that's fair enough. How about sovereignty when they're killing their own people? What do we do? And the second one is democracy. During the course of your discussion, you talked about the problems leading up to the election, and even worse problems that take place after the election, when all of the bad governance can take place. So if you don't have democracy, choosing whoever is going to direct the policies or the actions that follow, how do you get the right people? Is it purely accidental, or is it foreigners who come in, or what is it? Anyhow.
Thank you very much. On your first question, what do we do if a government starts killing its own people? If you're literally asking me, what do we do? I'll tell you, we do nothing, right? What should we do is much harder, but what do we do? I know, but let me tell you what we do and what we will do. Nothing, right? We will posture, cluck, fuss, and do nothing, right? End of story, basically. Let me turn to, and the right answer is we should avoid getting ourselves into that sort of mess. I mean, I'll have one remark on Darfur, which is a bit of a wild remark, but... to my mind, part of the problem of Darfur came from a somewhat careless settlement in southern Sudan. The southern Sudan settlement included a commitment to a referendum for independence, which is going to happen in, I think, 4 years' time. And that offering independence, creating yet another landlocked, impoverished, small African country, to my mind, is not a great idea. The rents to sovereignty are enormous. I mean, if you are a rebel group and you're told, you know, actually, you can become president of a country and, oh, you know, all that, and aid will shower in and all the rest of it. And so it was as soon as the Southern Sudanese rebel movement was given credible prospects of becoming an independent state, that the Western group, who had actually been in Darfur fighting, went back to Darfur and started a rebellion. Right? Now, of course, they had much to rebel about. There's always, people always do, right? That rebellion has been a total disaster for the people of Darfur. Right? The government of Sudan responded in a predictably ghastly way. But the real roots of that disaster, to my mind, go back to what I think of as a somewhat irresponsible settlement in the south. Now, that's not a fashionable view, but that is my view. And it's easier, I think, to get things right at that stage than to get things right at the present stage. Because at the present stage, we know what we do in practice. Nothing. Right? Whereas at that earlier stage, we could have designed history differently, very easily. Final remarks on democracy. In the early 90s, there was this wave of democratization across Africa, and it was a very hopeful time. And to an extent, it still is. But it's proved more complicated than many of us thought. Right? In particular, in low-income societies, especially where there's natural resource money, the temptation to embezzle that money to buy the election is enormous. And what we've got with these instant democracies is intense electoral competition in the context of very few checks and balances on how money can be used. And so what we're seeing is a very degraded form of electoral competition, a race to the bottom in which you win by embezzling more money than anybody else and bribing, buying, and intimidating with that money. And so there's some good features of democracy. I don't want to overplay that, but it's not as good as it ought to be, and it's because we thought democracy was easier than it is. You can get electoral competition anywhere. Iraq, Afghanistan, no problem. The incentives to participate are overwhelming. Checks and balances are in nobody's in their public goods, and so nobody's going to provide them. And without the checks and balances, electoral competition can be pretty lethal. Can I just say thank you very much for inviting me, having such wonderful barrage of questions. I should say I am more than happy to sign any books.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you.